Welcome to episode 37 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I'm joined today by Maury Shank, who's an advisor to Steptoe's London office and a member of our telecom, internet, and media group. We have a guest commentator today, Rob Corbett. Welcome, Rob.
Hi there, Stuart.
Who is a partner head of the Technology and Innovation Group at Arthur Cox, a large Irish law firm with a market-leading practice in data protection. And he's in town. We took advantage of the fact that he's here to catch up with him on a variety of Irish data protection issues, which, for those of you who are in the know, is one of the principal data protection regulatory jurisdictions in Europe. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and record holder for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So let's get started. I'm going to do what I think is a teaser rather than a deep dive, because I'm hoping that Jason will join me next week in talking about this issue, because NSA program, principally NSA, not exclusively, that allows the government to pick up foreign targets whose communications have one end in the United States or the transit through the United States, has been the subject of considerable litigation and now has turned into kind of a notification nightmare for the government, it's going to affect the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which goes around designating Belarusian oligarchs and Putin kleptocrats as specially designated nationals, as well as large banks and other institutions that are thought to be engaged in financing terrorism or the Russian government. Now it turns out that it is quite possible that those designations, which all rely on classified information, will have to spur some kind of notice to the designated nationals that they were surveilled by the U.S. government under one of these programs. The story of how that happened and the potential implications for people with a Treasury Department OFAC practice are something that I'd like to talk about next week. So I'll leave that for now. It's a fascinating story of what I suspect is screw-ups at very high levels in the U.S. government. So let me then turn to the second topic, which is how bad it is these days legally to be a provider of web services. It used to be everybody loved web publishers and the possibility of crowdsourcing this and that so much that they were willing to listen when big web publishers said we couldn't possibly police everything that happens on our system. We should be immune from liability for what others say and do if all we do is make it possible for a large number of people to join together in reviewing what's been said or done. And that principle is fading away, along with the notion that the internet should be the same everywhere. The most obvious example of that, and Maury and Rob are pretty familiar with this, is the localization of data, the requirement that if you're going to provide social media and other sorts of web services where you're dealing with the private information of individuals in a country, you need to keep that data in that country. And the Russians, perhaps as payback for Western sanctions, have begun saying, we're going to enforce the law. We're going to require that Google and Facebook and Twitter all register and be regulated under Russian law and start localizing that data as early as, what, Maury, January of next year?
Yeah, that's my understanding, is January 1st, 2015, people will have to comply. There's also another new law on requiring registration of bloggers, where there's recently some of the big U.S. internet companies have been informed by the Russian communications regulator that they have to register as blogging platforms, which imply it's not the local storage requirement, but it's another major ability to regulate content. And my understanding is that may apply even sooner to them.
My goodness. So that's the one that, if I remember right, has all kinds of don't use bad language and don't repeat rumors that aren't true kind of regulatory impact.
Yeah, in the hands of Vladimir Putin, that can be interpreted creatively, let's say.
Yeah, I think probably we could get banned for describing his cronies as kleptocrats. So it's a good thing I'm not subject to the Russian regulation.
Well, you know, it's over 3,000 subscribers. We're probably doing pretty close to that, or maybe more. So if we start, you know, projecting ourselves into Russia, you better watch out.
Well, I think we're up to 10,000, although we have no idea whether those are reliable numbers. So, we definitely meet the requirement globally, but I'm not sure we have 3,000 listeners in Russia yet. So, Rob, have you had clients who have gotten caught in the Russian regulation, or who've been storing all their data in Ireland and now may have to split it up?
Yeah, so this is obviously it's an emerging issue, but given the profile of the companies that are located, have their European headquarters in Ireland, you're talking major social media players for whom this is likely to have an immediate impact. If you're LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook, Google, they all have significant operations in Ireland. I think it remains to be seen how this is going to play out. There's some talk that the mirroring of data in Russia may be a means of doing as little as possible to be technically compliant with the new Russian laws.
That would make sense, and it would be deeply ironic. This is supposedly a result of objection to Snowden and a protest against U.S. capabilities to investigate stuff. I've always suspected it was just so that the Russians could get their hands on this data too.
Mm-hmm.
Mirroring solves the problem of letting the Russians get their hands on it, but it, of course, does nothing to improve privacy. It just doubles the number of governments that can dip into the data.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of looked on with a bit of amusement in Ireland as the whole Snowden thing played out. I mean, the morning after the controversy first broke, the Data Protection Commissioner in Ireland, who's just retired, Billy Hawkes, came on national radio and openly asked the question, why was everybody so surprised that the U.S. government were involved in certain surveillance activities, and quite rightfully pointing out that all European Union member states also had some surveillance capabilities hardwired into their legislation, whether or not it was hardwired into their networks also, I'm not so sure. And he wondered aloud what all the fuss was, and of course that prompted certain criticisms from some of his colleagues in continental Europe for not getting very animated that Angela Merkel's phone was being listened to.
Yeah, but I suspect that's been their view of him for a long time, that somehow he's not with the program of continental Europe, which is that everything's a violation of data protection, especially if it's an American company.
That's right. I think doing crazy things like talking to companies, you know, trying to understand where they're going, what they're trying to do in terms of their compliance, engaging with them, that type of thing, it doesn't always play out very well in the eyes of other data protection supervisory authorities in Europe.
Yeah, well, but that's partly because they have the luxury of not actually having a lot of these kinds of problems to struggle with, so that they can be purists about it. I wanted to talk about this, so maybe we should just jump into it now. Obviously, for perhaps tax reasons and other economic reasons, a lot of companies set up business in Ireland, and that has had a lot of tech companies, and that has had a secondary impact of them bringing a lot of their data protection problems before the Irish Data Protection Commissioner. What is the politics of data protection in Europe? Is this part of a Irish industry-friendly strategy to say, well, we'll also be reasonable about data protection? Are there just not as many privacy enthusiasts in the Irish public as there are in, say, Germany?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more complex than that. I think it's very tempting to look at a country like Ireland and say we're giving companies an easy ride. That's a kind of lazy view, to be honest. We're all subject to the same European directive. We've transposed the directive like everybody else. We've got a regime that's not big on bureaucracy. We like to attract businesses to come into Ireland. We market ourselves. Our Prime Minister markets our country as the best little country in the world for doing business. But independently of government policy in relation to things like tax and inward investment, the role of the Data Protection Commissioner in Ireland is independent of government. It's recognised under the European Treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, as being statutorily independent. The DPC in Ireland, the Data Protection Commissioner in Ireland, is well capable of giving companies a good kicking, usually when they've deserved it. And I think for some reason that tends to be construed by some companies as giving an easy ride, but a lot of that narrative is driven by privacy advocates, sometimes small in number but loud in voice, who tend to be based in continental Europe. And the attention it gets is significant because of the profile of the companies and the issues that people are trying to play out. So typically we've had Facebook audited twice by the Data Protection Commissioner. All of their non-North American activities, data processing activities, operate out of Ireland. The Germans were surprised that an Irish regulator could have jurisdiction over their personal data housed by Facebook in Ireland under the control of an Irish company. So they sought to challenge the jurisdiction of the Irish Data Protection Commission.
The data protection authorities of Germany did.
Huh? Yeah, and but actually, funny enough, the German courts sided with the view that Facebook's operations in Ireland were substantive. Absolutely, they had an Irish company there. They controlled the data from there. The directive is intended to be somewhat harmonising across the European Union. So even before they reform the European laws, which is what they're proposing to do, as you know, in relation to one-stop shops and all of that good stuff, there was an acknowledgement that the correct jurisdiction to regulate Facebook for privacy purposes in Ireland was in Europe was Ireland. And as a result, an awful lot of attention focuses in Ireland. I think your second point is also right. I think you don't have to look too far back in the last century to some of the invasions of privacy that were close to the heart of those in Central European and continental European countries. Ireland was less affected by, World War I, World War II, and the likes. And we've also had a constitutional right to privacy enshrined in our constitution since 1937. So we've kind of lived with privacy as just a human right that sits there with lots of other rights for quite a long time.
I hadn't thought about that. The Australians call themselves the lucky country, but, If you skip both world wars, that makes Ireland, at least in the last 100 years, a remarkably lucky country.
Sure, yeah.
So, actually, one of my rules is that you only get strong signals intelligence services in countries that have been in a shooting war in the last 50 years, because that's when people become very sensitive to the need to do intercept. What is the general Irish view of interceptions? What's the relationship with Great Britain with respect to intercepts? So that's a fraught relationship. So I wasn't sure how much Ireland actually appreciated the mechanics of and the practicalities of interception.
Yeah, it's something that gets far less public attention than it would over here. So there's quite a well-developed mechanism in Ireland for interception of communications messages. It tends to happen outside of the public domain. The communications providers who are subject to typically warrants from state agencies, the police in particular, but the revenue commissioners and the permanent defence forces in Ireland also have rights of access to communications data. They tend to operate in a very efficient way that the particulars of which don't tend to get aired in open court. So the systems work. Many thousands of communications are intercepted in Ireland. There hasn't been a history of abuse.
Right.
Well, there have been one or two high profile cases, one in particular of a journalist alleged to have been under suspicion of murder, having had his records unlawfully accessed by the police in Ireland. But those cases are few and far between. So we don't obsess about the surveillance society in Ireland in the same way that other countries seem to.
So were the did the Irish authorities have to do a lot of intelligence gathering around the troubles in Northern Ireland because of the spread across the border?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very small island. Belfast is about 100 miles from Dublin, you know, and yet it was like living in two different planets for many, several decades in the 70s and 80s in particular. But despite the international perception that Britain and Ireland have an unholy tension between them, in fact, they work incredibly well together when it comes to issues of national security. There have been one or two incidents back in the 70s where perhaps all sides didn't come out smelling of roses. But by far the more common situation was very well amicable cooperation between the two jurisdictions. And now that the troubles are well and truly at an end and the peace process has proved happily to have resolved many of the issues in Northern Ireland, the alliances that now maintain between Northern Ireland, which has a certain amount of self-determination in its local government, the United Kingdom government itself and the Irish government, cooperation levels have never been better, including in criminal justice areas.
Yeah. And so what does the future hold for data protection under the new regulation that we're seeing? You talked a little bit about one-stop shop. Do you want to unpack that about what it's likely to mean for companies and whether there's going to be even more work for the Irish Data Protection Commissioner?
Yeah, I think one has to expect if they ever get around to adopting this regulation, which is, I think there's been 4,000 amendments to the original text so far. I think I read somewhere during the week. It wouldn't be surprising if there were another 4,000 before it got through. But the anticipation within Ireland is that, in particular, the idea of this one-stop shop, this main establishment principle, which is, if you like, the payback to the multinationals for an enhanced level of data privacy and data security regulations, the payback will be that they don't have to worry about complying with 28 different countries' national transposing laws in terms of how they operate within the European Union. And the key will be, where is their main establishment within the EU? And if you're a large internet company with a physical establishment in many European countries, you need to look closely at how your main establishment might be construed. And one would anticipate a certain amount of forum shopping.
Right. Well, people will clearly want to game that to some extent because, you know, the data protection authorities of Germany are particularly crazy, although actually the Spanish and the Italians give them a run for their money. And the French.
The French, too.
Yes. So you clearly don't want to be designated as having your principal place of business there. Well, how much room for maneuver is there?
Yeah, and I think companies, they looked at this closely when the regulation was first published, because it was anticipated that we'd be subject to the regulation by now. And a lot of thought went into it. But my suspicion is that the ball hasn't landed yet on what it means to have a main establishment. Typically, these issues get fudged in European Union legislation. and there's this famous Article 29 working party of data protection supervisory authorities. You've got to sit down beside each other every month, and I'm sure some of the sidebars there are quite interesting in terms of who should be regulating whom.
Right.
Under the existing directive, and the new structures they're proposing under the new regulation won't make that much difference. So I don't think, I think it's going to be something that will be fought out, notwithstanding how much clarity we get in the text.
And who will have the authority to make that final decision? Is this going to be a situation where the French just say, I'm sorry, I think you've got more contacts with France than with Ireland, so we're just going to take jurisdiction, and the company, if they don't like it, has to go to court?
Yeah, I think that's going to drive the agenda here. So it's going to be, I think there's going to be plenty of litigation under the new regulation, and it will probably result in case law from the European Court of Justice determining in a piecemeal basis the rules as they should be interpreted. And as you can see from the Right to be Forgotten case or other cases, those judgments don't necessarily always provide you with the clarity you are hoping for.
In that case, they provide with a little too damn much clarity.
But it's a peculiar thing in Europe because they... The European Court of Justice is structured to answer specific questions put to them by national courts. And, we're not really used to that within Ireland or common law jurisdictions, where we're used to having the whole case heard before a judge and getting a reasoned opinion. Typically in European, Court of Justice decisions, they're simply answering points of law, and sending the case back to the national court to determine the substantive issue. Excuse me. So, what you tend to have then is brick by brick, interpretations, built up over time in relation to areas like this where there's a huge amount of room for interpretation. And I think that there's too many different interest groups with, too much to win and lose in this area, not to anticipate lots of litigation, I think.
And I can't help thinking that, the tax issue plays over into this, that there will be an inclination, as you already see with their treatment of the UK, to say, well, there are real Europeans, and then there's the Brits and the Irish.
Mm-hmm.
I remember distinctly going to a dinner with a data protection group when I was in government, and one of the European Union commissioners, commission employees, said to me about the Eastern Europeans. She said, you know, the Eastern Europeans are very different. They're the first group of new members who hasn't been grateful to have been admitted, which is fair, but I probably feel that way about Ireland now, that Ireland has had enormous success as a member of the European Union and yet has gamed the rules from the point of view of Brussels, both on taxes and I suspect on data protection. Do you actually expect to see some kind of formal effort to restrict Ireland's ability to regulate in this area?
Well, I think that there's two things. I mean, the tax thing is high profile at the moment. There's an investigation ongoing in relation to what guidance or notes or comfort was given to Apple in relation to its transfer pricing rules. The Irish government's got to fight that one tough, and it'll play out over the next 18 months or so. They feel fairly confident of their position on that. But I think you're right, the tax treatment and the whole broader OECD and other developments around base erosion and all of that thing, the macro treatment of tax matters and how Ireland has fared in the last couple of decades, that is definitely influencing the way people are looking at Ireland from a regulatory perspective generally. And if you've got advocacy groups driving the agenda here, and with a regulator who has got a limited enough right of reply,
mm-hmm.
It's very easy to throw lots of mud.
Yeah.
And it's hard for somebody in a relatively small office in Ireland to try and fight fire with fire there in terms of arguing their case. to be honest, I think clients who coexist in with significant presences in Ireland and the UK would, and those with further afield, they talk about Ireland and the UK as being very similar type of jurisdictions in terms of how they approach data protection as an element of compliance, like lots of other elements of compliance.
Right. Trying to actually make the law work as opposed to just treat it as an opportunity to say, well, you must be in violation because the data protection laws don't actually permit you to do business if you actually adhere to them in their strictest terms.
Yeah, that's right. But UK companies are much more measured about what they would say about the Irish treatment of data protection. They wouldn't see any significant differences between the two countries, maybe nuanced differences around the edges. And I happen to get to know Christopher Graham in the Information Commissioner's office recently, and I know that he works very collaboratively with the Irish DP Commissioner when it comes to European issues, because they tend to have a common view of industry and how data protection sits within industry, which might contrast a little bit with that of other member states.
So has Billy been replaced?
Yep. So we have a new data protection commissioner just in the last couple of weeks. Her name is Helen Dixon, and she is an interesting person. She spent some time working for technology multinationals over a decade ago, but in the last decade or so she's worked in the public service, and in particular in the last 5 years she's headed up the company's registration office in Ireland, where she has been part of a group undertaking the most significant reform of Irish company law in the history of the state. She's certainly very good reputation from the work she's done in that sphere. She's not somebody who's been steeped in data protection all her life, so she'll have to get up the curve on that. But I would have very high expectations of her, and I think Billy Hawkes was a hard act to follow.
He was a charmer and yet reasonably substantive as well, achieved great prominence. I think a lot of people, a lot of companies have confidence in Irish data protection law largely because of his outreach.
Yeah, and we're kind of happy with that. We're proud of that. I think the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, Billy, when he came in about 9 years ago, he didn't anticipate having the profile he would have. It was largely seen as a domestic sort of almost regional office with looking at principally domestic issues. And a couple of years later, he's all over the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times in relation to what he's doing with Facebook.
So, well, he handled it pretty well, and he obviously enjoyed it too. And what's he going to do?
He's going to fully retire. I think he's, I was speaking to him recently, I think he was looking forward to enjoying a nice glass of wine without people, nagging him about data protection emergencies.
So, speaking of data protection law and beating up web companies, I see that the Article 29 Working Party has actually spoken now, I'm reminded of the writer in New York, a female writer whose name I'm blanking on, speaking of another a female writer, said every word she speaks is a lie, including and the. I have to say, it's hard not to feel the same way about the European Article 29 Working Party. They've put out a document which purports to bust myths about the right to be forgotten. My favorite, I mean, it says, it's a myth. Content will be deleted. No, content won't be deleted. It just won't be findable. Or that the judgment contradicts freedom of expression. No, they say. It doesn't contradict it. It just balances it until there isn't any. But my favorite was that the judgment allows for censorship. And they say, oh, it's not really censorship because that's government censorship. And this is censorship first by Google and Microsoft, and that's not the government. And then second, it's censorship under the data protection agencies, and they're independent of government. So that couldn't be government censorship. And then the courts will review it. And you know, they're not government either. So there's no government censorship to be found. I thought it was hilarious. They're obviously sensitive to this, but I'm not sure they are improving their case when they do this. The New York Times now has been victimized by Right to Be Forgotten. They've had five stories go down the memory hole. I don't know, Maury, did you see the that story? Yeah,
I like you, am troubled by this. I was interested. We had David Hoffman on a few weeks ago, and I was surprised that he was relatively friendly to the Right to Be Forgotten.
Well, you know, I will say he's. If you listen to him closely, I thought he was mostly saying, if you're stuck with the data protection directive, this is a reasonable interpretation of the data protection directive.
Yes, I mean, yeah, I guess that is what he said, although I don't think you had to get here. And I was thinking about why he came out that way, and sorry to deflect you from the New York Times story, although I think that's just sort of an example of what will happen. But I see something developing here, and this ties back to our previous discussion of the big guys like Google, the new guys like Google and Facebook who deal in data, and the more traditional players like Intel and Microsoft, who deal more in products, who are less unhappy with European data protection. And, you know, you mentioned the Article 29 Working Party. They've come out quite recently with letters both to Google and to Microsoft. And the Microsoft one is quite friendly. Thanks for your some kind of enterprise privacy policy. And to Google, it's quite aggressive. We don't like your privacy policy, and here's about a dozen ways that you could fix it. So, you know, I agree with a lot of what Rob said earlier, but I think there's somewhat of a political agenda here, so it would come down on your side on that, Stuart, I think.
It is, and I think Google is symbolic to data protection authorities across Europe, and maybe to Europeans, or at least to German media companies. Hostility to Google is something that people, you know, they get with their morning paper every day, at least in continental Europe.
Yeah, well, and absolutely. And I think that there, although these data protection principles are being applied according to law, I think there is a political dimension here, particularly in Germany. Germany's probably the most obvious case of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it is also true that, as I said earlier, the idea that companies ought to be protected from liability and nurtured as they're providing these magnificent new web services is really eroding everywhere. You know, Apple has a very serious breach of security. Celebrities' nude photos are suddenly easily obtained by hackers. And lawsuits are ready not against Apple, but against Google. Companies and celebrities are saying, we insist that you take down any links to these photos on a theory of liability that probably sounds more in copyright than, or maybe some old Brandeisian privacy law. And Google, by and large, has just quietly said, okay, we're taking it down.
Well, I agree with you. That's maybe the first time ever, Stuart, that, you know, I've made a comment that's more critical of the European situation than you have, so I'm kind of gratified by that. But I agree, these are global problems.
Well, stick around. We'll Rob, how would the celebrity nude photo case be handled in Europe?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think the what you've got with the whole Google being caught in the headlights here as an intermediary does have echoes of what traditionally we would have looked back on 15 years ago in the e-commerce directive about being a mere conduit and
right,
not being not being
that's pretty much gone now.
Liable, yeah. There was also a thing called a country of origin principle that directive as well.
It
doesn't
is
work
funny
so well
all
either.
All that stuff gets kind of tossed out.
Yeah. So these things, the more they change, the more they stay the same. I think what's happened with that right to be forgotten case is they've shoehorned internet search engines into the terminology of the Data Protection Directive. You couldn't just be a search engine. You had to be a data processor or a data controller. And they want you to be a data controller because they can control you if you're a data controller. And I think that's what's going on here. And I think the concepts of personal data, data controller, data processor, they're so embedded in European law, yet they're increasingly straying from the reality of how data is actually processed in a globalized economy. That there's this kind of impasse developing as to what regulators think they can regulate in the context of data and what they should be regulating.
Yeah, I think that sounds exactly right. Well, let me turn to the last story that I thought was particularly troubling, and that is the news that J.P. Morgan was the subject of a deep intrusion. It didn't result in compromised accounts, but the depth of the intrusion meant that the hackers actually got access to the standard software profile that is loaded on all of J.P. Morgan's machines. And it would not have been a surprise to discover that there was a deeper penetration that would have allowed access to accounts. And what was troubling about it, oddly, was how little interest the hackers seemed to take in actually getting access to credit card information that they could cash, because that suggested that maybe this was Eastern European hackers with a direct tie to the Russian government, and that what the Russian government was planning in the long haul was a form of Russian financial sanctions in which they don't just impose the sanctions, they take all your money too. In the U.S., that's being treated as something that requires a notification as a data breach, but the notification rules don't actually require any action here this time, because there's been no credit card or other financial information compromised. So the only disclosure requirement probably will come from the SEC, which will require notice to investors about the intrusion. This is going to raise questions about whether other banks need to be disclosing information. I don't know, Maury, Rob, what's the European rule on disclosure of breaches of this kind?
Well, this is one of the changes that will come in with the new directive. At the moment, there is a breach notification requirement for electronic providers of public electronic communication services. And Rob, I think, will agree with me, it probably wouldn't apply to J.P. Morgan here. But the new data protection regulation would apply more generally. And so there would be, a couple years down the road, a breach notification obligation in these circumstances. On the U.S. point you made, Stuart, one thing, a story I saw on this, which I thought was very interesting, is said that a lot of the J.P. Morgan stuff was personal profile information that could, even though it wasn't financial, would be really useful for stealing identities. And so, a credit card number can be changed, but you can't easily change the color of your eyes and your date of birth and things like that. And it suggests that maybe, if you believe in this breach notification regime, that the things that are disclosable needs to be broader.
Yes, I think that's right. Frankly, the reason we're worried about J.P. Morgan is not necessarily that we think they're going to steal our money, but that they're going to cause a a collapse in service, and just a day of JP Morgan not being able to settle its accounts would be a disaster for the global financial system, from which Russia has been largely excluded. So they would sit there subject to sanctions saying, boy, sucks to be you. So that we've created an incentive for them to feel that it wouldn't be so bad if JP Morgan suffered some serious problems unrelated to stealing money from them, although I'm sure that taking money would be a pleasant byproduct of any other part of an attack. So I the one last question I wanted to ask Maury, did you see that apparently in London the latest bargain that you can get is you can get free Wi-Fi in exchange for the lives of your firstborn? F-Secure to demonstrate how dangerous it is just to hook up to a Wi-Fi that you randomly find in the tube or in a hotel lobby, offered free Wi-Fi, and there was a click-through of the terms of service that said, well, we have a Herod clause, which means that if you accept Wi-Fi, we can take your firstborn at any time. I'm kind of assuming that that isn't enforceable in Great Britain, did it produce any consumer protection pronouncement?
I'm embarrassed to say that I have not seen this important development in Great Britain.
Well, you know, you may have inadvertently given Lily away.
Yeah, count your kids when you get home.
Apparently, because it must be a joke, and I think I can say for confidence that that is not enforceable under British law.
Now, if you're a mortal soul, it might be, because that would be a separation of church and state. They wouldn't want to get involved in that.
Yes, exactly. I don't know. The election here is very close, so I'm scratching my head to see whether Labour or the Tories could come up with some way to play this in their favor to push the election. But that would probably be the only way that this would get traction.
Yeah. When is the election?
It will be sometime next year. I think it's got to be called by mid 2015. Elections here don't have a set date. They're within 5 years of the previous election.
Well, it'll be at a time, presumably, when Nigel Farage has been caught doing something inappropriate, because that's what the conservatives are most afraid of.
That's what everybody's waiting for, yep.
Okay, well, we're going to close it off now, because we're running low on time. Apologize, it's a little shorter than usual, but before we finish, I like to ask our participants if they have any events coming up or other products and services they want to plug. So, Rob?
On the 13th of November, anyone who's listening to this and who wants to come to Dublin, we have our annual Data Protection Practical Compliance conference is on. In Dublin, it'll be the ninth year of the conference. It's best data protection conference in Ireland anyway. I was going to say in Britain and Ireland, but I better not offend Maury.
And Maury, you have any speeches?
I don't have anything to top Rob today, so I'll let him stay with saying it's the best.
All right. Well, tomorrow night I am debating the ACLU and a variety of other folks over whether mass collection of telephone data violates the Fourth Amendment for Intelligence Squared. That'll get covered by National Public Radio. So listen for that. It's a very formal debate, not as formal and maybe not as entertaining as the Oxford Union, which I also got to do. Reviewed a few of those tapes from other debates before doing it. And my favorite was the crusty old, I think probably a former MP who stood up and said, I resolved the last time I did this never to do another one sober. And I am sticking to my promise. So that's my events. I want to thank you all for joining us. Close. This has been episode 37 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. We hope you'll join us next week when we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. And don't forget, the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast is now open to feedback. And I know if you've been shouting at your phone or iPad during these discussions, now's your chance to call us at 202-862-5785 in the United States and leave a message. The most thoughtful and or entertainingly abusive will be played on the air. Or if you'd rather do something boring like an email, you can send it to cyberlawpodcast@steptoe.com. Thank you very much.